Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Transfigured. I'm here with Dr. Jonathan Losos. He is the author of a book that we're going to be talking about. It's called Improbable Destinies, Fate, Chance, and the Future of Evolution. And you are also a professor of evolutionary biology at Washington University in St. Louis. You were previously a professor at Harvard. I believe you got your PhD from Berkeley. Am I remembering that correctly?
Correct, yes.
And you've been given almost every accolade in the field of evolutionary biology that I'm aware of, and are, I'll just say, probably one of the leading figures in your field at the moment. I was looking on Google Scholar. You have over 500 scientific publications and over 41,000 citations, which for people who don't know these things, that's a lot. So you're very highly distinguished in your field. I first ran across your work. I was just telling you this before the recording was on. So I was in grad school at Harvard in biostatistics, and I was in the Harvard bookstore, like the official one. And there is a new faculty publications section or something like that in the bookstore. And I saw your book and I saw its title. I'm like, oh, that sounds really interesting. Picked it up, read the preface, decided I needed to read that. And I think I devoured it in maybe like 2 days and emailed you with some questions, and you were gracious enough to respond then. And I would say it's impacted my thinking about evolutionary biology and those sorts of questions more than almost any other book that I've read on the subject. I feel like the scientific details in it are fascinating, but it's also one of those rare books that sort of thinks about the subject in a higher level, almost philosophical way, while simultaneously dealing with, you know, actual nitty gritty studies and stuff like that. So with that introduction out of the way, do you want to talk a little bit about your own personal biography and how you became interested in these sorts of subjects and how you became a professor of evolutionary biology?
Well, thank you, Sam, for those extremely kind words. I think you exaggerated numerous times, but I appreciate you doing so. And it's a pleasure to be joining you here today. So I have spent my life as an evolutionary biologist. I began when I was a little boy, first interested in dinosaurs, like so many kids then and now, that then transformed into living lizards. But I was always interested in evolution. And even as a teenager, there was a scientist then named Stephen Jay Gould, who was at Harvard, who was a great writer. And he wrote a lot about evolution, explaining the principles and the ideas in a magazine called Natural History Magazine, which is still around. And he wrote these great essays about many of the topics that we're going to talk about today. And so I read those and was just fascinated. And then as I went through school, the more I learned about the study of evolution, the more fascinated I became. And for various reasons, I've ended up spending my career studying a particular type of lizard called the anole, or technically it's in the genus Anolis. These are small lizards that live on every Caribbean island throughout all of Central America, down into much of South America, and in the southeastern United States. And they turn out to be a great subject for studying evolution for a number of reasons. First, they are tremendously successful. There are more than 400 species of this particular type of lizard, much more so than almost any other kind of lizard or any other type of vertebrate animal. Moreover, they are very diverse, that in any one place, you can have as many as 15 different species living in the same area, and they've evolved to adapt to different parts of the habitat. One will live high in the trees, one in the bushes, one on the twigs, and so on. And then they have features that make them adapted to use those parts of the environment. And so they're a great organism to study evolutionary principles. Oh, and the other thing that's good about them is you can study them in many ways. You can go out and watch them and observe what they're doing. You can capture them and bring them into the lab to study their movements and their physiology. They're abundant, so you can collect lots of data. And so in many different ways, you can study them to put the different parts together to understand how they exist in their current environment and how they may have evolved through time. And so those are the lizards I've spent my career studying, and they have one very interesting pattern, and that is on the large islands of the Caribbean, by which I mean Cuba, Jamaica, Puerto Rico, and Hispaniola, there are many different species, as many as 64 or so on Cuba. And we can build an evolutionary tree to understand how they're related to each other. And this evolutionary tree is very much like a genealogy that you might have of your family. It shows, you know, the ancestral species and then how the species today have branched off in different combinations. And so you can do that these days most easily by sequencing the DNA of different species and comparing their DNA. And essentially, based on the assumption that the more similar two species are in their DNA, the more closely related they are, you can build this evolutionary tree. And when you do that, all of the lizards in Jamaica are all more similar to each other, more closely related than they are to the lizards on any other island. And what that indicates is that Jamaica, basically what happened is one lizard of this type got to Jamaica and then diversified, producing many species, producing the six that have occurred today. And for the most part, with a few exceptions, that's true on each one of the four islands, that they have been independent evolutionary radiations, we call them. And so looked at another way, the four islands have independently, separately, had their own evolutionary histories of these lizards. And so we can compare them as four different cases, examples of evolutionary diversification. And when we compare them, the interesting thing is that the same types of species have evolved on each island. And so what I mean by that is, say you go to Puerto Rico and you walk into the rainforest in the mountains there and you sit down and you don't move around. And after a few minutes, the lizards forget you're there and they become active and you can see them. And there could be as many as six or eight different species. And you're sitting there and there you see where they are, and they'll be living in different parts of the habitat, up in the top of the tree, down in the grass, on the narrow twigs, on the tree trunk, and so on. And they have different features. The one on the twigs has very short legs, which lets it move very carefully over the narrow and irregular surfaces. And the ones high in the tree, they have really big pads on their toes that let them stick on and so they don't fall off from the top of the tree. And the ones near the ground, they have really long legs, which lets them run quickly, and so on. So there are these different features that make them adapted to where they live. Well, the interesting thing is if you go to the different islands, you see the same set of types on each island. So for example, if you remember the twig ones with narrow legs, they're also very slender and very light in color to blend in with their background. If you go to, say, Jamaica, you see a lizard that looks almost identical to the one on Puerto Rico. And the same thing on Cuba and on Hispaniola. And yet we know that these species are not closely related. They're not similar just because they all have the same ancestor that was like that. Rather, they evolved independently to adapt to the same environment on each island. And that's true of basically six different types that occur on the islands. They have evolved independently on each of the four islands, with one or two exceptions. So that's the interesting pattern, that evolution has occurred independently on the different islands, and yet it's produced very much the same outcome each time.
So for people who don't know, anole lizards, like if you've ever been to Florida and you see a lizard scramble across the pool deck that sends out an orange thing on their neck, that's sort of lizard. I remember I grew up catching those on my grandparents' Florida pool deck when I was a kid. So this is the type of lizard. Anyone who's been to the Caribbean or the southeastern United States has seen these lizards before. So the interesting thing that you're saying is that there are repeated types of lizards on these different Caribbean islands. And there's maybe one type of lizard that lives high up in the trees that has really grippy fingers and toes. And you see the same type of lizard on all of the different Caribbean islands. And there's another type of lizard that seems good at running up and down the tree trunk, and another type of lizard that seems good at running on the ground. And they have particular insects or snails or whatever prey that are their main way of making a living. And you might think that the lizards that all look the same on the different Caribbean islands that all live on the treetops, that they are descended from one type of treetop dwelling lizard who had managed to colonize all the different Caribbean islands, and that each type is related to some ancestral shared type that also colonized all of the Caribbean islands. But instead of that being the case, and we didn't really know this until we were able to genetically sequence them and look at their family tree through genetic sequencing, that it actually turns out all the lizards on Jamaica are more closely related to the other lizards on Jamaica. And they aren't more closely related to the lizard that looks the same as them and that's over there on Cuba or Hispaniola or some other island. They're actually all more closely related to their fellow island dwellers, which suggests that evolution had a way of basically repeating the same outcome, more or less. Maybe there's a couple of variations of difference, but what initially seems recognizable as the same types of lizards on all these different islands, that some Anole lizard got to these different islands, and then it's like the same experiment happened over and over and over again. Is that basically the general idea?
That is basically the general idea. It's not basically the general idea. You nailed it. That's exactly correct.
All right.
I want to make one slight change just for transparency or honesty. There was a man at Harvard, a wonderful evolutionary biologist named Ernest Williams, who was the grand old man of the study of these lizards. And what is amazing is that he, for the most part, understood these patterns before we had the data to actually demonstrate them, because we didn't have DNA sequencing. And he said, look, this is how they're related, just by studying specimens. And he didn't have the modern methods to analyze the data that he did have. And yet he got it all right anyway. And so I have to give him credit. He's the man who really came up with these ideas, and we've just used modern techniques to show that 90% of the time he was absolutely correct.
Mm-hmm. And this ties in with the larger subject of convergent evolution. And convergent evolution has been, I mean, that's as far back as Darwin himself, noting that species that serve similar roles in their environments, even in different places, often seem to evolve similar traits to meet the needs of that environment. And so in some case, the process of evolution bears similar repeated results in different parts of the world. That idea is as old as the theory of evolution itself. But the idea that this radiation, what you call where one species turns into many different species, that even at that level, it would be repeatable, was sort of a new idea. And do you want to talk, was that idea met with resistance from your colleagues, excitement, both? How was that received?
Well, it was met with excitement because, as you said, the idea of convergent evolution has been around for a long time, but until recently, it was still considered to be kind of remarkable that, you know, species in different environments, because they don't have to evolve the same way. And so the fact that they did was just seen, isn't this incredible, the power of natural selection to sculpt different species to be so similar? And so just single examples of convergence used to get a lot of attention when they were discovered. And so to say that we were having not a single case, but six different types living together were all converging, the entire community was converging, that was sort of a higher level of convergence. And so people were very excited about it. In more recent years, we've seen that there are other examples of other sorts of organisms, but anoles were probably the first example to be worked out in really thorough detail, including evolutionary tree analysis and so on.
Mm-hmm. And I remember another detail in your book, as we continue to genetically sequence more and more animals, we've even discovered lots of things that we thought were all the same species as turning out to be very, very different from each other in terms of their family tree origin. but yet they can look so remarkably similar that they had flown under the radar as actually being the same species for a long time until this DNA analysis was done. Am I remembering that correctly as well?
Yes, you are. Just to give you one example, there is a type of sea snake. The sea snakes are snakes that live in the ocean basically their entire lives. There was one that was thought to be found throughout much of the world, from Australia to Asia and throughout the Indian Ocean and into the Pacific. And when people looked at the DNA, they found that their DNA of different populations of the species were very different. In fact, so different that the populations weren't even closely related to each other. And so it became clear that this very great similarity was the result of convergent evolution. And it turns out that was particularly important because these snakes are highly venomous, and their venoms were different, that their external appearance was very the same, but their venoms were not. And so understanding that these were not all the same thing actually had a lot of medical importance.
Yeah. So even, and that's amazing that the similarity was even at the level of appearance, like coloration, stuff like that, which sometimes you might think, you know, sea snakes, it's almost a little arbitrary. Maybe it has to do with sexual selection and some particular, you know, history of their organism that they come to be colored the way they are. But even at the level of coloration, they were evolved from different types of snakes as their sort of parent or ancestral species and converged to look remarkably similar and to be highly venomous. Although sometimes, like you said, the venom, the actual molecule of venom that they used might be different, but the idea that you need to be highly venomous was the same. So it's remarkable that it's almost like convergent evolution is becoming more and more the expected norm as opposed to a curious example or something like that.
Well, that is absolutely true. And in recent years, there have been a number of people who have produced enormous books, you know, some of them this thick, with just example after example of convergent evolution. And as I mentioned a moment ago, we used to think that convergent evolution was a remarkable but unusual event. And that's why every time a new case study was presented, people would get so excited. But what these compilations demonstrated is it's a lot more common than biologists appreciated, so much so that some people now considered to be the expectation that if two species live in the same environment, they will adapt to it in the same way. Now, that might be taking it too far to the extreme, but we certainly recognize that convergent evolution is a lot more common than we used to appreciate.
Right. And it almost brings up the larger question of what exactly do we mean by species? And that we can be talking about species at the level of they all reproduce with each other, they have a shared genetic origin and stuff like that. But then there's almost like this extra word that we need, like fills the same type as, or is serving the same niche as this thing over here that we previously might have thought was the same species, but it turns out is a completely different kind of sea snake that just looks identical to the kind of sea snake across on the other side of the Indian Ocean. And it's almost like to even recognize convergent evolution, we need a new word in our vocabulary that's like, well, not species, but like ecological type or something along those lines.
You are correct. There are actually a bunch of terms that are used that are very technical ones. For the annals, we call them ecomorphs, that a species that's adapted to a particular habitat with a particular anatomy, it's called a morph, is an ecomorph. And so there are these different ecomorphs on the different islands. Plant biologists often call them ecotypes. And there's a lot of jargon, as you know, in evolutionary biology. So there are some terms out there, but a nice, readily understood term would be useful.
Yeah. So another thing that was really interesting. So while I was reading your book, part of why I think it resonated with me a lot is that in grad school, I was taking a bunch of Bayesian statistics courses at around the time that I was reading your book. And in Bayesian statistics, we often there's often no clear programmatic way to train a model to solve the mathematical constraints that it's trying to be trained into. So what you do, imagine that we've got 20 parameters on our model and we're trying to fit it to some particular piece of data, but we don't have a mathematical formula that we can just use to say, well, this parameter should be this, this should be this, this should be this, et cetera. Many types of statistical modeling, we do have closed formulas to solve our model building. But for many types of models, especially now with artificial intelligence, there is no closed formula. So what you do is you take all the parameters, you give them sort of a random value to start. You grab one of them at a time and you tweak it randomly. And you look, did that improve my model or did that not improve my model? Oh, it improved my model. I'll keep that change. Oh, it didn't improve. It made my model worse. Never mind. Get rid of that change. And you do this iteration after iteration after iteration. And these are actually called genetic models because people have noticed that this is a very similar idea to how genetic natural selection works. And what you do is you run 10 of these in parallel, and then you hope that they converge at the right answer. And if all 10 of them came up with the same answer, then you're like, oh, great. Okay, then I know that this is the right answer. And if one or two of them end up somewhere else, then you'll have to like dig into your data and be like, well, why did that model end up with that set of parameters? That doesn't make any sense. And it was interesting reading your book and learning this Bayesian statistical method. And I'm like, okay, so we're expecting our computer models to evolve in the same, in convergently solve the same mathematical problem in the same way, even if they start from different points and they are using sort of randomness to feel their way towards the answer. And I'm like, well, that seems very similar to what these anal lizards are doing on these Caribbean islands, is that there are these potential ecomorphs, you could say, sort of out there in the environment that when they first arrive on the island are vacant, and that these lizards, through natural selection, not that any of them are thinking this consciously, find their way into the potential ecomorphs that are available based off of, I don't know, the constraints of their own biology and the constraints of the environment and those sorts of factors. I don't know if you've ever heard that that example from Bayesian statistics, but it's the idea that convergence should be expected and otherwise something has gone wrong.
I have not heard that comparison. I see what you're saying now that you put it that way, but I have not heard that. And it makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about another experiment. I don't think this was your experiment, but it's one that you talk a lot about in the book. It's about the guppies in the rivers.
Yes.
And the presence or absence of predators. Could you talk a little bit more about that study?
So this is a fascinating study. You're right. It's not my work. It's work that a number of people have spent a lot of time on. People like John Endler and David Resnick and others. Not that those names probably mean much to many people, but they're very famous scientists in our field. Basically, those experiments start with the observation that guppies. So guppies are the fish that everyone knows from pet stores that are very colorful and so on. Most people don't know where they come from. Well, they actually come from the island of Trinidad, north of South America, and then from Venezuela in northern South America. And they live in mountainous streams. And in some places, they are very colorful, just like in pet stores. But in other cases, they are quite bland. And I should say this is just the males. The females are never very colorful, but the males in some places are very colorful. Well, scientists, when they started to look at that, discovered that there was a pattern, and that was that higher up in the mountain, the guppies tended to be colorful, and lower down, they tended to be bland. And colorful or blandness correlated with the presence of a larger predatory fish called the pike cichlid. It correlated extremely well. And that led to the hypothesis that it was predation by the predator that affected the coloration. And the reason is that for some reason, females prefer colorful males. And that's another entire story why that might be, but the fact is they do. And so in the absence of predators, the most colorful male gets the most, mates the most, passes on his genes, and so colorfulness evolves. However, in the presence of predators, the colorful males are very obvious to the predators, they get eaten. And so in fact, it's the bland males who do better. And so their genes get passed along. And so that was the hypothesis. However, I should tell you just one more thing for what it's worth. The reason that you have predators at low elevations and not higher in the mountain is because there are waterfalls, and the guppies are able to actually get around the waterfall. We're not quite sure how, but probably on really rainy nights, they kind of swim through the leaf litter to get around the waterfalls. And that's how they colonize up the mountain. The predators can't do that. And so as soon as you have a waterfall, they're stopped. So we have this idea, presence of predators causes or prevents color evolution. But this hypothesis is just based on an association between presence of predators and bland guppies. And such an association, or sometimes it's called a correlation, we know that there's a phrase, correlation does not prove causation. Maybe it's a coincidence, or maybe it is something else that is responsible. Maybe it's just being higher in the mountains. It has nothing to do with the predators. It has to do with something else about being higher up. And so the classic way to answer this question is to do an experiment. That's the gold standard of science, in which you can control all the variables but one to see if that variable is responsible. And so in this case, the variable that you would control, the one that you would vary, is presence of predators or absence of predators. And so what these scientists did is they went to a place where there was above a waterfall, there was a pool that was empty. For some reason, the guppies hadn't gone up there already. Is that correct? No, there were guppies up there. They were colorful. There were no predators, mm-hmm. but there were predators just below the waterfall, you know, feet away. And so what they did was they just transplanted some of the predators to the empty pool, or to the pool with the colorful guppies. And sure enough, after a very short period of time, a couple of years, the guppies evolved to be much blander in color, demonstrating that it was the presence of predators. And then to confirm this experiment, they did the same thing back at the university, where they had big greenhouses, where they made little kiddie swimming pools, wading pools, and they recreated the environment so they could have many, many cases where they would have four pools with predators, four pools without. And what they found was the same result time and time again. The presence of predators led to the evolution of bland coloration. And so these experiments really did prove the causal reason for this convergent evolution.
And so did they do the reverse, where they ever took predators away from bland ones, or put bland ones in a tank without any predators and they became more colorful?
I'm trying to remember. They didn't do that in the wild because it's much easier to add fish than remove them.
Sure.
And the lab experiments were starting from scratch, so you could do that either way.
Yeah. And so it didn't take more than a few years for this color pattern shift to happen.
No, it was very quick. Now, anyone who knows guppies knows they reproduce very quickly, so even a couple of years is a few generations. But it was very rapid evolution. And that's something else that evolutionary biologists have learned in the last relatively few years, last few decades, is that when natural selection pressures are strong, evolution can proceed very rapidly.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just coloration, if I remember correctly, it was like maybe size and also sort of like boldness or flamboyancy or something like that, that you could say.
It was a whole suite of characters. So one of them was how bold they were, that, saying something as bold is anthropomorphic in a way, but let's just go with that for the moment. Yeah. The more willing they were to do things that were risky, in the absence of predators, you get rewarded for that. You get more food and so on. But in the presence of predators, you get eaten. And so the mm-hmm. behavioral tendencies evolved. Another thing was that when there are predators around, the given guppy's lifespan is likely to be short. And so what they would do is they wouldn't grow very large, but they would start laying eggs and breeding at a young age, because better mm-hmm. to breed early than to invest the energy to getting old. But in the absence of predators, they would grow to a larger size, and they would produce fewer offspring that were themselves larger, because mm-hmm. larger little baby fish have a competitive advantage. So the presence of predators led to a whole suite of characteristics changing But the sweep was repeatable from one pool to the next.
Mm-hmm. And so there's this whole combination of traits that was correlated with absence or presence of the predator fish. And yeah, that it didn't take very much time. Add some predator fish, they move in that direction. Remove some predator fish, they move back in the other direction. And I remember this was one of the questions that I had asked you back a couple of years ago, was, is there any evidence that those traits have been sort of genetically bundled together? Like I remember the fox domestication experiment, I believe from Siberia, where they selected foxes in a domestic environment for basically how easy or how comfortable they were when a human approached them or something like that. Yes. How sort of docile and friendly they were to humans. And that was the only thing they were selecting for. And then after a while, their ears get floppy, their tail wags more, they get kind of more spots in their coloration. They basically have all sorts of traits that we associate with domestic dogs that wasn't what they were selected for. They were just selected for docility, and all these other traits kind of piggybacked or were genetically correlated or interconnected with the genes that expressed the trait that was being selected for. And so the question that I had is, was there any evidence that these traits in the guppies, whether it's colorfulness, boldness, kind of waiting longer to reproduce versus shorter to reproduce, investing more in a few bigger offspring versus investing less in a larger number of offspring, was it possible that there were some, like, you know, kind of super genes that were causing some of these? And so the way that they could all evolve so quickly together is there's almost like some dial that they almost evolved to have to be like, am I in a predator pool or am I not in a predator pool?
Well, that's a great question. And your summary of the Siberian fox experiment was right on. And it's a fabulous experiment. And I do want to put a plug for a book written a few years ago that is very interesting and accessible on that topic called How to Tame a Fox. And it just shows exactly what you said, how by selecting on the calm foxes, they basically turned them into dogs with all the behavioral or many of the behavioral and anatomical traits, and which indicates that these traits are all linked genetically. You select on the gene for calmness and it has many different manifestations. I'm going to be honest and say I can't remember the answer to that question with the guppies. I want to say it certainly wasn't like the fox experiment where one trait, they were all very highly correlated. But I can't remember. The scientists who've been doing that, and probably the lead scientist these days is David Resnick at the University of California, Riverside. They've been breeding them in the lab. And so I'm sure they have the data and I'm sure they published on it, but I can't remember the answer. But it's certainly not like the Siberian foxes, because that would have been very interesting and surprising, and I would have remembered it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could almost imagine that in those guppies that might frequently go back and forth from predator present to predator absent pools, that the evolvability of adapting to that situation itself was almost some meta-evolved trait or something like that. And to connect those things together would help your offspring for a dozen or more generations into the future be able to outcompete the adaptation process compared to other guppies that couldn't correlate those traits together.
I certainly agree that that is a possibility, and people have studied that. So it's certainly possible. People have studied in other systems. I just can't remember the answer for guppies.
Yeah. So now I want to ask a couple sort of philosophical questions. What do you think your research about the convergent radiation of lizards says sort of about evolution itself? Like, I remember, you know, growing up, we always heard in biology class and sort of from, I don't know, culture at large, that evolution was random and unguided, and that it almost with the idea that animals were just sort of going in different directions, and that there it was mostly to be seen as a random process that one shouldn't look too much into. And your book, your the subtitle of your book is Fate, Chance, and the Future of Evolution. I feel like your book tugs on that kind of conception a little bit, being like, well, you know, this is so repeatable that, and there, the presence of these egomorphs that keep popping up again and again, it does seem, you know, maybe guided isn't quite the right word, but fated or something like that. I'm just wondering how this has altered your thinking on this, and how you would talk about how to view sort of evolution in general based off of some of the findings of your research.
So that's a great question, and my head is spinning, and I could go in so many different directions, but let me start by mentioning a famous statement by this scientist I mentioned before, Stephen Jay Gould, who really did a lot of the important early thinking on this topic. And he created what he called a thought experiment. And he said, suppose we could go back in time to whatever time you want to talk about, say 500 million years ago when life was first really accelerating, and start over again. Replay the tape, he said, replay the tape of life. Would the outcome be the same? You know, how deterministic is evolution such that you start in the same way, you end up with the same end product? Or on the other hand, to what effect are just random events, a tree falling down and killing a particular animal or
an asteroid from space.
Exactly. Or something like that. How significant are those in sending evolution down a different pathway? And there's kind of, at the extreme, two views on this topic. One view is that it's very deterministic, that species in the same evolving in the same environment will evolve the same answer. And that the anolis lizards would seem to be an example of that. If we assume that the environments on different Caribbean islands are essentially the same, which is an assumption, but they look pretty similar, then the lizards seem to have followed the same evolutionary path on each island. You know, they're replays of the tape, if you will, not in time, but in space, and they've got the same outcome. And some people have strongly argued that that's the case, that evolution is deterministic, that it follows the same course. And you could put that another way, that natural selection pressures are so strong that there are only a few optimal solutions, best ways of solving a problem posed by nature, and that natural selection will force species to find those same solutions time and time again. The other view is that the random happenstances that affect communities, just when a mutation happens to occur, a tree, an asteroid, will change the direction of evolution, and just over time, evolution will find a different course to adapt to a different environment. And so there's no predictability. And I want to give you an example of non-convergence that could be argued to be an example of the opposite outcome. And it has to do with animals that that eat insects inside dead trees. There are grubs, beetle larvae, that the adult beetle lays the eggs in a dead tree, the grubs hatch out, they eat the dead wood, and they grow up to be beetles. And this is what woodpeckers eat. And the way the woodpecker does that is it lands on a dead tree, and it goes bang, 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 bang with its hard beak. And what it's doing is it's listening for a echo of a hollow sound, the presence which indicates that there's a tunnel in the wood. And then when it finds it, it goes peck, 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 and digs into the wood and gets to the hollow part. And then it has this long tongue. The tongue is so long that it wraps around the skull. That's how, so it can stick out a long tongue. The tongue is covered with little hooks. It sticks its tongue into the hole, snags the grub, and pulls it back out and eats it. And that's how these woodpeckers, which occur on, I think, every continent but Australia, how they capture their food. Well, Madagascar does not have any woodpeckers. It's an island, a large island off the coast of Africa. Turns out woodpeckers don't like to fly across water, and so islands usually don't have woodpeckers. So there are no woodpeckers in Madagascar, but there's a very different animal called an ai-ai. It's spelled A-Y-E-A-Y-E, and if you've never heard of it, you should go Google some videos to see it. And an ai-ai is a type of lemur, but it's a very bizarre type of lemur. It's about the size of a house cat, and It's got a couple of features. Number one, it is the ugliest thing you've ever seen. It's got a face that only a mother could love. It's got these big, enormous, leathery ears, and it's got these big, protruding incisor teeth in front. And it's got these hands with this finger here is really long and skeletal. It's very thin. And so the eye eats the same food as woodpeckers. It eats grubs from trees. But it has adapted to use the same resources in the same sort of environment in a completely different way. Well, it's the same way, but it's evolved different ways of different tools, if you will. So what the eye does is it goes to the wood and it takes its long finger and goes tap, 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 tap. And its ears rotate around and they listen for a hollow sound, just like the woodpecker. And when they find the hollow sound, then they use their really powerful incisors to gnaw through the wood. And then once they find the tunnel, they stick their long finger into the hole with a sharp claw and they pull out the grub. So they do the exact same sequence of events as the woodpecker, but they've evolved very different tools. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, these clearly are not convergent. You'll never mistake an eye for a woodpecker.
Well, kind of convergent, but a different sort of convergence.
They've converged on the ecological niche, what they do in the environment, but they've evolved different tools to do that. I see what you're saying. But why, you know, why didn't a eye evolve into a woodpecker? Well, it's because they started differently. They don't have a beak to start with, but they do have teeth. They don't have, they've got these fingers that they could use instead of tongues. And so they're just very different animals. And so they had a different starting point because of the history of the different ancestors. And that led them to adapt in a very different way to the same ecological niche. And so one could argue that there isn't one single optimum solution. At least there are many possibilities. And it depends where you start, which is the one that you would evolve toward.
Right. If you start as a mammal and you don't have a woodpecker that you're competing with, and also I presume, are there large land predators on Madagascar that would eat them if they're going in between trees?
Well, there are a few, not as many as other places, but there are a few. But they actually, they don't come down to the ground very much. They bounce around from tree to tree.
Oh, okay. So they don't need to fly to get between trees without resorting to the ground.
Correct.
Although flying does seem like a better solution than jumping from branch to branch. But it was like perhaps a bridge too far for them to evolve flight and feathers and a beak and all of those sorts of things. But they could evolve a long finger and big teeth and really good hearing. And so it has to be within reach of from what is biologically available.
Yes. Can I just give you another example following on that?
Please do.
Penguins are brilliant swimmers. If you've ever seen movies of them, they zip along. Most aquatic animals that are fast swimmers power their swimming by a powerful tail. That's what sharks and tuna do. That's what alligators do. That's what whales do. Penguins don't do it. Well, why is that? Because birds don't have tails. They lost their tails 150 million years ago.
Or they don't have big, long tails. They might have a feather tail, but not like the sort of, not a flipper tail.
Yeah, and there's no bones in that tail. They've lost the bony tail.
I see.
Furthermore, they have these powerful wings. And so what they do is it's the same strokes underwater that they use to fly with. And so they have wings, no tails, so much easier just to modify the wings to fly underwater than to re-evolve a tail. And so that's what penguins have done.
Right. And so they have to exact things that are within their current biological history to meet the needs of the future. And so sometimes that results in very similar solutions, or sometimes it results in very different solutions, like a woodpecker having a super long tongue, but the eye having a super long fingernail.
Exactly.
They're accomplishing the same thing, even though they're using very different body parts to meet that sort of same biological tug, I guess you could say, of the ecomorph or something like that.
Exactly.
And then every once in a while, it would seem like there are these sort of, biological breakthroughs, I guess you could say, like placental mammal reproduction versus marsupial reproduction. Like if you look at the megafauna that used to exist in Australia, a lot of them have recognizable ecomorphs. You know, there's things that look kind of like lions, things that look kind of like wolves, things that look like large land herbivores and all those sorts of things. And then they sort of go extinct seemingly when humans show up, maybe, maybe not. But also they have trouble if a placental mammal is introduced to Australia, because there's seemingly something perhaps just, you know, fundamentally more efficient about placental reproduction. But placental reproductions maybe only evolved once. And so there are occasionally these breakthroughs at a very fundamental level that can then open up new niches or fundamentally alter which animals are competitive in a niche or something like that.
That's certainly the case. I need to stick up for my Australian colleagues and say that there's a new view on marsupials. That used to be the old view, that the placentals are just better at reproducing. It's now, I think, many people argue that marsupials are better adapted for the very unpredictable environments that often occur in Australia, where droughts and major flooding seasons are much more common than elsewhere. And in that case, the advantage of, I won't get into the details, of being a marsupial is you don't invest much in your babies early on. And so if things go bad, well, you haven't lost that much and you just reproduce again in a little while. Whereas in more predictable environments, investing more in their embryos, as placentals do, seems to be a better strategy. And so people have argued now they're not necessarily better, they're adapted to different environments.
I see.
I have to tell you how I know.
Go for it.
Once years ago, I had an Australian undergraduate come visit my lab to think about going to graduate school. And she had just been to another university where she sat in on the mammalogy class, where they just happened to be lecturing on reproduction of mammals. And they had lectured that marsupials were inferior. And she was deeply offended because that's not how she'd been taught back home in Australia. And so that's how I kind of learned that there were two views. But I think that Australian view has now become dominant.
Interesting. And you and I both live in the Midwestern United States. Any idea why possums are successful as marsupials in their particular niche?
I mean, this is a fabulous counterexample, that the idea that marsupials are inferior. Look at who's doing great today. The opossum has basically, in relatively recent geological time, moved from being an animal in Central America, it's now in Canada. And it is a species that is truly thriving in the messed up world we've made for animals. So it's clear that marsupials can do well under some circumstances.
Yeah, they love the suburbs. I see a lot of, besides squirrels or rabbits, I think I see as many opossums as anything else. So let's see here. I'll switch gears a little bit. Any last thoughts that you had about sort of that kind of higher level philosophical implications you think about? You said you had lots of wheels turning in your head or different directions you can go. Any directions that you didn't get to pick up the first time that you want to go this time?
Just one more, but I think you might be getting to it. And that is the question of the inevitability or predictability of particular types of organisms, say humans. Is that where we're headed, or should I?
That seems like an excellent question. I'll go with that. Were humans inevitable?
All right. Excellent question. one of the things that evolutionary biologists have wondered is how predestined was it that humans or something like humans would evolve? And, you know, I think one of the funny things is if you watch science fiction movies or read books or so on, or TV shows, and they go to other planets so that life has evolved separately, the life there is usually very similar to what we see on Earth. You know, for example, the intelligent being usually is humanoid, or maybe it has three fingers or antennae or something, but it's basically a humanoid thing. And like the Avatar, at least the first movie, I haven't seen the other ones, the organisms were basically things on Earth that they gave it an extra pair of legs or did something different. And, you know, maybe that's a lack of creativity, or maybe these people are evolutionary biologists who just think that life is destined to evolve in the same way. And so one question is, what would life on other Earth-like planets be like? But the other question is, you know, suppose life had happened differently here on Earth, would we, not us personally, you and me, but would something like humans have evolved, or is it just the flukes, the chance events that occurred? And this again was a question brought up by Stephen Jay Gould, and this is where he had a famous quote. I don't have it exactly right, but he basically said, if we replayed the tape of life again, you know, if we replayed it a million times, humans would never evolve again, that we are just the unlikely result of these various events that occurred, that had they not occurred, evolution would have gone in a different way. And of course, the obvious, the best point, the best turning point, if you will, was the asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs 66 million years ago. And before the asteroid hit, mammals were a minor player in global ecosystems. They did exist. There were lots of types, but the biggest ones were maybe the size of a groundhog, and most of them were smaller. They were little rat-like or shrew-like things in the underbrush. The dinosaurs ruled the world. And the dinosaurs were still doing great after 150 million years of evolution. And then the asteroid came along and wiped out much of life, and the mammals then took over. And so what if that asteroid had missed the planet, hadn't hit? Many people, and I think myself included, think that the dinosaurs might still be here today, or who knows, but certainly life would have gone in a different direction, and it would not have produced humans in the way that it did in the absence of the dinosaurs. And so I think many people hold that view, but there is, go ahead.
Or would we have gotten a dinosaur that met the ecomorph of humans?
Well, that is a excellent question. And so there is a British scientist named Simon Conway Morris, very prominent paleontologist who's done spectacular work. And he is one of those people who's published actually two different books with just huge lists of convergent species. And he has argued that convergence is so common that in fact it's ubiquitous, and it should be the expectation. And he has argued specifically that something like humans was inevitable, that we have particular constellation of traits that makes us very favored over the long term, and that evolution was destined to produce us. And he has two different scenarios. One scenario is the one that you just asked, and this is to my mind kind of amusing in a way, but back in the 1980s, a Canadian paleontologist discovered a new species of dinosaur that was very similar to Velociraptor, if you remember the star of Jurassic Park. And Velociraptor had a big brain by dinosaur standards, and its portrayal in the Jurassic Park movies is actually pretty reasonable of it being a relatively intelligent animal. And moreover, dinosaurs, through the millions of years, their brain size had been getting larger and larger compared to their body size. And this new dinosaur that the Canadian paleontologist Dale Russell found had the largest brain of any dinosaur yet seen. And it was right before the asteroid hit. And he wrote this technical scientific monograph describing every bone of that dinosaur, which is what they, you know, that's what paleontologists do. But at the end, he included a very speculative section that was very unusual in a paleontological scientific paper, where he speculated what would have happened if the asteroid hadn't hit. And what he argued was that there was pressure for dinosaurs to evolve bigger brains because they were smarter and could do better. And he said, as the brain gets bigger, he argued, the animal needed to get upright to balance the brain over its head so it wouldn't have a floppy head. And so the neck got shorter, and so it wasn't flopping around. And maybe for reasons he didn't really explain, the muzzle got shorter. And as they were standing upright, they didn't need their tail, which is used to balance an, velociraptor, if you can picture them walking around. Mm. And so he became very upright. And essentially, he argued, you'd have a humanoid, a human-looking dinosaur, which he called very inelegantly the dinosauroid. And so that was his hypothesis, that dinosaurs would have produced a human-type species given enough time if they hadn't been wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
It was a it was fun. But it turns out that people like Simon Conway Morris and some others have taken this very seriously. And they've argued that, look, even if the asteroid hadn't come, the dinosaurs are still around, we'd still have something like humans today.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was, Conway Morris also argued, even if the asteroid had happened, wait, let me think about this. There was another argument, and that was 30 million years ago, it got colder. And Conway Morris argued that the dinosaurs, being reptiles, would have had to move to the lower latitudes because they couldn't stand the cold at the poles, and mammals would have evolved then, and the same pattern of human evolution would have evolved, of mammal evolution producing humans. It would have just been delayed for 30 million years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is, of course, pure speculation, because how can you test that sort of idea? But the point is, some people, like Conway Morris and others, argue that actually, because of the ubiquity of convergent evolution, human type organisms were destined to evolve on Earth, and by analogy, on other Earth-like planets.
Mm-hmm. That there's an ecomorph waiting for someone to claim.
Exactly. Some species to claim. That's mm-hmm. that's essentially what the argument is.
Interesting. I want to turn to ask you about cats. You wrote a book recently about cats. Could you remind me the title?
Well, I'm happy to shamelessly plug my book. Here it is. It came out a year ago. It's about how cats evolved and how scientists study them.
So I take it you're a cat person, both from your book and the tail that is flopping occasionally behind your head.
Let's show you the whole thing. This is Archie. He's my buddy. And so, yes, I am a cat person, have been all my life.
I grew up with Siamese cats. My family has had a couple generations of having Siamese cats as sort of our standard family cat. My wife's less of a cat person than I am, so we currently don't have any cats, although maybe someday, who knows.
I hope for you.
So where did cats come from? How did we end up with cats in our house?
Well, that is a very interesting question. And so in deep time, felines evolved 30, 35 million-ish years ago. The very first fossil feline, called Proailurus, looks like a cat. Its legs are a little short, but I like to say, if you saw one walking down the street, you'd have no doubt that was a cat. And so we don't know the transition to becoming a cat, because we don't know what their ancestor was. So cats have, by the same token, cats have been cats for 30 million years, with, you know, variation in size and a few other things, but they've stuck to pretty much the same formula. One interesting sidelight on that is that 20 million years ago, the cat world diverged into two groups, and one of those were the saber-toothed cats. And for most of those 20 million years, it was the saber-toothed cats that were most dominant in terms of species and perhaps even numerically individuals. And the other types, which are called the conical-toothed cats, there were less common. But then very recently, the saber-toothed cats went extinct, leaving us with the cats that we have today. So I like to think, what if the saber-tooths had survived and the conical-toothed cats had gone extinct? Would we have saber-toothed house cats?
Or would that just be too scary of a prospect?
I wish we had them.
Where did the domestication of cats happen? Or are cats not really domesticated and they've been fooling us this whole time? Something I've always wondered.
Well, those are two excellent questions. The cats were domesticated, to the extent that they are domesticated, somewhere in the Middle East, in the area called the Fertile Crescent, which spans, depending on how you define it, maybe from Egypt all the way around the Mediterranean up into Turkey. And so it clearly happened then. The native wildcat species called the African wildcat, wildcat is the name of the species, is clearly the ancestor because it looks almost identical to a domestic cat, and the DNA studies have confirmed that. We know that by 3,500 years ago in Egypt, domestic cats existed because the paintings on the tomb walls is very clear. You have a domestic cat. The first archaeological evidence goes back to 10,000 years from the island of Cyprus, where you have a burial of a cat clearly treated very nicely, but we can't tell if that's a wild cat or a domestic cat because skeletally they're identical. So somewhere in this region, between 3,500 and 10,000 years ago, the domestic cat was domesticated. Now your question is, are they really domesticated? And they are often called semi-domesticated or barely domesticated. Those aren't scientific terms, but it's pointing out that they're not very different from their ancestor, as opposed to compare a dog versus a wolf, or a barnyard pig versus a wild boar, or cattle versus their ancestors. They're all very different. But the domestic cat, really, your standard, you know, feral cat, if you will, not a pedigreed cat from a specialized breed, but your standard cat is hardly different from an African wildcat, North African wildcat. They breed readily when they're in the same place. I like to say that if a North African wildcat walked through your backyard and you looked out and saw it, you wouldn't say, you know, what's an African wildcat doing in St. Louis? But you'd say, what a cool looking cat. I've never seen one quite like it. I mean, they're really that similar. So they're very only slightly changed and so only somewhat domesticated. And that's why they go feral so easily, because they aren't that different. It's easier for them to revert to their ancestral lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. And what was sort of, do you think that we chose them or they chose us? It sounds like the history that you mapped out is very similar to, say, the history of agriculture and, you know, large permanent human habitation. And so did we just have some mice that needed to be eaten and they found the mice, or we're like, man, we need to do something about these mice. What about those cats walking around? What if we gave them a little bit extra milk to encourage them? Or how do you think that happened, or any evidence on that?
Well, I think that you've laid it out. Of course, it's hard to actually know, but I think most people agree with the following scenario. And that is, when agriculture first began, and people settled down into villages and started raising crops, well, they grew as much food as they could in the good season and stored the extra in wherever they stored it. That in turn attracts rodents. And in turn, rodents attracted the wildcats there that lived in the area, but not all wildcats. One of the things that we've become aware as scientists in the last few years is that cats have different temperaments or personalities, just like people do. And so one could imagine that the North African wildcats that were bolder, that were more willing to be around people, would benefit because there'd be more food. So they would have more kittens and pass on the genes to being bold and tolerating people. So step one is certainly cats took the lead in taking advantage of the food. But then we can also envision that people saw the benefits of having the cats around, eating all the rodents. And so maybe they did things to encourage them. Maybe they provided milk, which isn't really good for cats, or warm place, let them into the house or whatever. Again, the boldest cats took advantage of that, passed their genes on. So then you have cats in the house, and let's face it, kittens are adorable. And so maybe people started stroking them, and the ones that would tolerate that. And you could see this coevolutionary dance between us welcoming them and growing to like them, and the cats evolving more and more to tolerate people. So I think it was a back and forth, but I think cats really drove the bus, if you will, and determined it in causing this to happen.
Mm-hmm. Did cats evolve, or did the domestication of cats, or the semi-domestication of cats, happen multiple times in different places, or did it kind of just happen once, or is it kind of too messy to answer because there's always been a semi-permeable, interconnection between the wild cats and the domesticated cats, and it's hard to ever really say?
So that's a great question, and it can be answered at two geographic scales. It is true that many of our domesticated animals, maybe most of them, have been domesticated multiple times, and over broad geographic areas, Eastern Asia and Western Europe and so on. And you can
see another example of convergence for the record.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And the DNA, so there are four different wildcat types, five actually. There's the European wildcat, the South African wildcat, the North African wildcat, the Asian wildcat, and then the Chinese mountain cat is also a wildcat. There were some people who thought that the domestic cat might have been domesticated in multiple places across those continents. And the DNA study very clearly showed that's not the case, that the DNA of domestic cats and North African wildcats is barely different. And so they clearly, the two are very closely related. So they were domesticated just in this one area. But what we don't know was it a single place? Was it the island of Cyprus? Was it Egypt? Or did it happen across that whole area, maybe multiple times? And we just don't know the answer to that. And as you said, it might be hard to even tell that because, as you said, they might start to get domesticated, move somewhere else, then breed with the wildcats, and the genes would keep on getting mixed up between them. Mm-hmm. So certainly the broad scale, only once, but very narrowly, maybe a few times within a small area in a small period of time.
Interesting. So the Siamese cats that I grew up with were more closely related to wild cats from the Middle East or the Fertile Crescent than they were to a type of wild cat that might have been found in Thailand or something.
That is absolutely correct. And so what happened is very clearly after evolving in somewhere in the Middle East, they then migrated or people carried them from Egypt or other areas, north to Europe, east to Asia, south into the African continent, and then ultimately from Europe to North America and to Australia. And so, yes, and then over the relatively brief period of time, 2,000 years or so, in places like Thailand, they differentiated it. They evolved differences. So you have the long, slender, I think, beautifully elegant cats like Siamese. And in Northern Europe, they tend to be stockier, squatter cats. So that is the history. And recent genetic studies have brilliantly detailed this diaspora of cats from the Middle East to the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. When did that, is that relatively recent or is that relatively ancient?
The archaeology can date that because you start seeing either cat skeletons or paintings of cats, and they got into Greece maybe 2,500 years ago. They were sneaking, the Egyptians tried to keep them from getting out, but they got out, got into Greece even 3,000 plus years ago. Then from Greece through to the Roman Empire, and then over the last 2,000 years throughout Europe. And then Asia, you see them, I don't have the dates exactly, but maybe Pakistan 300 BC, India 200 BC, China about the same, and Japan 600 AD. So the archaeology shows when that happened.
Yeah, fascinating. All right, I think I'll bring us to a close pretty soon, but are there any last thoughts you had, either about cats or the destiny of evolution that we haven't discussed that you want to talk about?
Well, you've done a great job of covering these topics, and I think we did a great job of covering these various things.
All right. Well, Jonathan, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much. I'll add links to the description of the video for the books that we discussed. And so I would encourage people to check that out in more detail. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Sam. This has been a great pleasure.